Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly on August the 6th. Coming up on this week's show, Kate Allen joins us to discuss Amnesty International's campaign for internet freedom and the links between technology and human rights abuse. Plus, we'll bring you more on the pioneering technique that's brought a patient out of a six-year coma. We discuss the controversial new proposals around IVF and children's right to know who their father is. All this and Brian May. Yes, the Brian May. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Well, last week it was all about the floods, and this week it's all about the heat wave. Joining me in our positively sweltering pod this week and trying not to melt in the August sunshine, it's tech correspondent Bobby Error Johnson.
You do not compute, Alok.
Ian Sample is the Guardian Science correspondent, and we're always delighted to have him here.
Hello.
Hello too to Nell Bowes from Guardian Unlimited's Arts Desk.
Hello.
And finally, Science Weekly producer Ben Green is here, and in a moment of deep metrosexuality, he's gone and dyed his hair a striking shade of red. Very nice. Our special guest this week is the director of Amnesty International, the human rights pressure group, who recently launched their irrepressible campaign for internet freedom. Whilst we all use the web for sharing ideas or gathering information, as well as wasting a lot of time on Facebook, several regimes around the world control and limit the content that can be accessed online. In countries like Vietnam, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, people are regularly persecuted or imprisoned for using the internet to criticise their government or expose human rights abuses. And companies like Microsoft, Google and Yahoo have also been condemned in the last 12 months for bowing to the Chinese government's demands to actively censor their services. So, plenty to discuss when it comes to the links between technology and human rights. Kate Allen, welcome to the pod. I just want to start by asking you to go through what the Irrepressible campaign is trying to do.
What Irrepressible is about making sure that the web is truly universal and that people can access it and use it without censorship. It is an incredible tool. I mean, it really is something extraordinary, and it could be something that could really help the progress of human rights around the world. But there are regimes, and you've mentioned some of them, who have clamped down on the use of the web and on people using it. China, for example, the Chinese government invests a huge amount of money and resource and web police to block people's access to sites that they think are undesirable. So if you enter the word democracy into a Google in China, you won't get anything.
I mean, it's something like that happened to the Chinese journalist Xi Tao. I mean,
yes. Xi Tao is a Chinese journalist who is at the moment doing 10 years hard labour. And what Xi Tao did was he sent an email to somebody in the States telling them the instructions that he'd been given as a journalist by the Chinese government on the 15th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. So he was told how to cover that. The Chinese government found out that it was Xi Tao because he was actually shopped by Yahoo. Yahoo actually told the government that it was Xi Tao, and Xi Tao is now doing 10 years hard labour. These things are completely unacceptable. The internet companies who say that they are about inclusivity and so on, that they behave in this way.
What do you think that we can do here? Are you suggesting that the governments here should be complaining about this, or is it more a case of a grassroots action from members of the users of the web?
Well, I think people like Yahoo and Google and are very susceptible to consumer power and consumer pressure. And so what Irrepressible is about is, at the moment, we are gathering signatures to a petition. We have 70,000 plus at the moment. And we've already seen these companies come to our table to start discussing the principles on which the internet and access should be made available. So it's starting to have its effect, but we want more and more people to join that particular campaign.
Companies like Google and Yahoo have huge amounts of money that they want to make out of China. Bobby, can I bring you into this?
Yeah.
What's the situation with those companies breaking those markets and sort of dealing with some of these human rights issues?
Well, this is one of the big questions, really, is this balance between internet rights, and most of the internet companies kind of paint themselves in a fairly libertarian stance. So, you know, they're all for freedom of information. But when they launch new businesses in these countries, they have to decide whether they want to be complicit with the regimes there. So China, we were fairly critical of Google launching in China, and they've admitted now that they maybe have done it in the wrong way, but they haven't really changed what they do.
Well, their motto is don't be evil, isn't it?
The thing there is that they have a censored index. So, you know, on the one hand, they're saying we can tell you everything that's on the web. On the other hand, you know, you search for Tiananmen, you don't get what you expect.
Yeah. I'll give you an example too on Google. If you look for a picture of Tiananmen Square on Google, you get the picture that we all know, that iconic one of the man stood in front of the tank. Of course, if you do that in China, what you get is happy, smiling tourists in Tiananmen Square having a nice day out. Now, that is that's outrageous. I mean, that is just so shocking that Google are doing that. You know,
Is it actually employees of Google, or is it the Internet Police actually in China that are censoring?
No. It's Google. That is the service. Mm. That is what people in China have access to.
Because previously they had run. You know, you could access Google.com, and you still can access Google.com some of the time from China. But the Great Firewall will block certain things, whereas this is about, you know, the companies actively kind of working in the framework that the government sets out. But I wanted to ask, Kate, the interesting thing when you talk to these guys, to the Microsofts and the Googles and especially the Yahoos, is that they say, well, this is a two-pronged attack. You know, on the one hand, we are trying to get more information to ordinary people in these regimes, and we are doing some of that. But if we didn't cooperate, we wouldn't get anything to them. So they kind of, you know, it's kind of piecemeal stuff. So I just wondered what Amnesty's position is on that.
Well, that, you know, sounds quite good, doesn't it? But, you know, let's be absolutely clear. The information Yahoo gave the Chinese government means that Xu Tao, a journalist, is doing 10 years hard labour. That's the worst kind of signs of what they do. But they haven't even used their commercial muscle. So, you know, they haven't got together Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, and actually tried to use their muscle in terms of how they negotiate with countries and governments like the Chinese, the Vietnamese and others.
How successful do you think that a campaign like Irrepressible can be, considering that the problems with China, they're not just about the information access. I mean, there's a huge cultural issue going on there, and all sorts of companies are trying to get involved in business with them and in having problems and so on. And China is a very sort of constrictive regime. How high up do you think this will be on for example, Microsoft's radar when they've got so much money they can make out there?
I think they've got that money, but they also have reputation. And I think if the rest of us make it clear that we're not prepared to see people in prison for simply sending an email on, we can't underestimate the power, the consumer power that we have. You know, the way that all this technology works allows people to voice their opinion. And I think that, you know, the more that we can do that and get people joining this particular campaign, the more we can actually display to these companies that it's unacceptable. We had school children making these points directly to some of the companies that we've been talking about, and you could just see the absolute embarrassment of the people that were sent out to talk to them. You know, people working in these companies don't like it. People like us don't like it. We need to bring that together.
Kate, thanks very much. People can find out more information at irrepressible.info. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we discuss the revolutionary deep brain stimulation technique and its impact on patients in near vegetative states. Plus,
there is a great relationship, I think, between astronomy and music, which has always been there. A lot of the great astronomers have been musicians, and vice versa.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango? We hear from the guitar legend and astrophysicist, the soon-to-be Dr. Brian May. But first, it's time for a roundup of the other science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days.
News Jack.
The man at the heart of one of the greatest scandals in modern science actually made a dramatic leap forward in stem cell research without realising it. Woo Suk Hwang, a stem cell scientist from South Korea, fell from grace last year when an official inquest found he'd faked data on human cloning. But researchers looking at his work say he inadvertently achieved a world first, extracting stem cells from human eggs that had developed into early stage embryos despite not being fertilised by sperm.
Climate scientists have blamed global warming for a dramatic rise in the number of storms in the Atlantic over the past century. Their study showed the average number of storms that develop every year has doubled since 1905, and they suggest the trend is due to a rise of almost 1 degree Celsius in the surface temperature of the Atlantic, a phenomenon that has already been linked to climate change.
Children born from donated sperm or eggs will have the information marked on their birth certificates under changes to fertility laws proposed last week. The proposals amount to a demand from Parliament for the government to tear up May's draft fertility bill in favour of a more permissive approach in ethically contentious areas such as the creation of saviour siblings and the use of surplus embryos in research.
And finally, a combination of coffee drinking and regular exercise may help to lower the risk of developing skin cancer. The two work together to kill off precancerous cells whose DNA has been damaged by UVB radiation from the sun. Rates of skin cancer in the UK have quadrupled for men and tripled for women in the past 25 years.
A few things I think we can go on to from those stories. Ian, tell me about Woo-Suk Hwang.
Well, this was a study by some stem cell experts at Harvard University and Cambridge and a couple of other places in around Boston area. And they basically looked back at the studies and the work that Hwang's group had done in South Korea. And obviously, this was the guy who said he had made patient-specific stem cells in 2004, but then had to the paper was withdrawn after it was found to be sort of totally made up. They used this weird technique where they found a way of genetically fingerprinting stem cells in such a way that you can tell what kind of embryo they were taken from. And when they looked at Hwang's data, they found that some of his stem cells must have come from unfertilized eggs. And the only way you can do that is that sort of you nudge the egg into kind of dividing. It almost thinks it's been fertilized. It just divides on its own right for a few days. The real advantage of doing that is that you can have stem cells which are genetically identical to the donor of that egg, so you can use them for tissues
this
for that woman.
Virgin birth stuff, isn't it?
Well, it's funny.
Tell me why I'm wrong.
You get this. It's called parthenogenesis. You get this in certain lizards. You get it in Komodo dragons, seen in sharks. You don't think you can get it in humans because you need genetic input from the male sperm to get a viable embryo going. But yeah, I mean, it's not a, you're not going to get any virgin births out of it, put it like that, but it is a virgin development of an egg, if you like.
Another of the stories was about the draft fertility bill and parliamentarians looking into, you know, what has and hasn't been allowed in that. We've talked a lot about this before in terms of, you know, the use of hybrid embryos and stuff. One of the interesting lines this week was the fact that sperm donors will not be anonymous anymore. I wonder how you guys feel about this. Is it ethically right if someone wants to be anonymous, Ian?
What was interesting about this is the parliamentary committee that was looking into this said that they felt that the government shouldn't be complicit in a parent's deception of their children. So while you may get parents who won't tell their children that they've been created from donor sperm or donor eggs, the government shouldn't play along with that, and so it should be printed on what's called the long form of their birth certificate. Now, I know the British Medical Association doesn't feel very comfortable about this. It feels that there are certain reasons where you might want to sort of keep that information back, like if parents are sending off a birth certificate to get a passport for the children, or the birth certificate's going elsewhere, that information may actually come out and get into the hands of people before the child knows. And there are issues of sort of medical security, information security there.
I wonder how this relates to adoption law as well. I mean, you know, if you're adopted, it's on your birth certificate, you know, who your birth parents are. It's not exactly the same, but it's there are always parallels to be taken from other processes around the place, so it depends where you draw the line, really.
OK, well, we're going to leave that there. To give us your thoughts on any of these topics, head to the New Science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. You may have read last week about the pioneering brain surgery that led to a man coming out of a 6-year coma. The patient, whose family wanted him to remain anonymous, was left in a near-vegetative state after an assault in 1999, but following the surgery at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, he can now open his eyes and track people across the room. He's also able to speak a few words and make some very small voluntary movements. Ian, you were reporting this story, but before you tell us more, here's what the patient's mother had to say.
After the procedure, I'm going to cry. After the procedure was over with, my son can now eat, watch a movie without falling asleep. He can drink from a cup. He can express pain. He can cry, and he can laugh. The most important part is he can say mommy and pop. He can say, I love you, mommy. God bless those wonderful doctors who believed in my son and gave their time and effort to help my son. And I can't thank you all enough for what you've done. And I want to tell all the mothers out there that don't ever give up hope. And I want you to know I still cry every time I see my son, but it's tears of joy.
clearly a very emotional woman there. Ian, let's talk about this story. How did this patient get to the stage he was in? Well, how did he get into the coma?
Well, in 1999, he was on his way home and was involved in got caught up in a street robbery. He got really badly assaulted. I mean, he was pretty much left for dead, and he got he had to have emergency surgery, after which the doctors called in the two parents, the mother we just heard, and said, look, if your son survives the next 72 hours, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. He then spent about 6 years in sort of specialised nursing care, where he couldn't speak. He would occasionally attempt to, like, mouth words and stuff. He very rarely opened his eyes. He could just make the odd movement, but who was in a really, really deeply brain-damaged way.
So what did the scientists do?
Well, what they did was they used this technique called deep brain stimulation, which is used pretty widely now for controlling tremors in people with Parkinson's disease. You run electrodes into a part of the brain, and then you have pacemakers in the chest which stimulate that part of the brain. And in Parkinson's, you use it to kind of block the tremor signals. In this, what they did was they ran the electrodes into twin parts of the brain called the central lateral thalamus. Those areas have specific nerves in which stretch out to other parts of the brain, the frontal cortex, the basal ganglia, which are really key for attention and stuff like that. And they excited them sort of 12 hours on, 12 hours off for a good deal of time. From day one of doing this, the guy regained a lot of his, not an enormous amount, but made a pretty dramatic improvement in his condition. From day one of switching this kit on, he opened his eyes, he was able to track people around the room. He's now able to speak 1 to 3 words at a time. Although they also asked him if he could repeat the Pledge of Allegiance, which I think in the US you probably know off by heart. And he managed the first 16 words without prompting. He can brush his hair, he can hold a cup and drink from it. I mean, these are extraordinary changes, all the more so because you don't get this long after being in such a deep coma. You would expect any improvements to happen within 6 to 12 months afterwards.
Ian, I'm kind of interested, given we're doing ethics today, rather, in how do you get permission to experiment on someone who can't say yes?
I think this was one of the key issues for the ethics panel that gave the eventual go-ahead for this trial. You can ask the parents, as they did, as the researchers did, and the parents gave approval, but there is still this question of how can you recruit a research subject to a trial when they themselves can't give permission? And the scientists argued that it is because the treatment is looking at exactly this problem that they felt that it was justified, that the very question was that you wanted to try and make this person conscious enough to be able to participate in questions like that. With all of the other considerations involved and the safety of deep brain stimulation already, the ethics committee gave it approval.
There's something else which is quite interesting about this, which is that if this becomes a technique that you can use fairly regularly to wake people up from comas, then aren't you just going to prolong people in comas in the hope that one day they'll be able to be woken up? I mean, sometimes parents and loved ones might say, look, let's switch off the machine now. They've gone on for too long. I mean, I'm not suggesting for a second here that this is a bad idea, because it's clearly, in this particular case, it was a good thing that this patient woke up. But it's really, really tough area.
Well, it's interesting, because why are people kept alive in these conditions and in persistent vegetative state? Presumably it's because the parents and the other loved ones, the family and so on, it's their decision and it's their request. Now, when you bring someone out of that condition and they are more conscious, then obviously the responsibility for that presumably at some stage shifts to them. But this is really interesting ethical territory, I think. Actually, this is the first technique that can actually speed up or even change someone's outcome from one of these really bad brain injuries. And I think that those questions are new because of that.
Final question. What does this mean for other people in comas? Can they also be fixed?
Well, the researchers are saying, look, one case study. And they chose this guy because he was at the top end of consciousness, which is still classified as minimally conscious state, which is the sort of the technical term for the state he was in. They very much doubt you could do anything with people in persistent vegetative state with this. That state is actually closer to being brain dead, and that they just don't think that there's enough left in the brain that's functioning that can be reawakened, if you like. With people with minimal conscious state, they're going to try it on other people. It's a case of looking and seeing. I think but it's such a spectrum of conditions that you have here that the idea seems to be that the better off ones will get better, the worse off may still be left where they are.
We'll leave that there, and feel free to continue that discussion on our new science blog. Now though, some music. Let me go. Let me go. Let you never. from brains to Brian. So yes, producer Ben, you're very happy with that one, aren't you? Now, Brian May is of course best known for that and many other guitar solos in his career with Queen. We've been trying to get him on the pod since we launched almost 18 months ago, but it's taken till now for us to be able to get close to the Brister, or should that be the Maester? Yes, Brian was at Imperial College in London last Friday to hand in his PhD thesis with the snappy title Radial Velocities in the Zodiacal Dust Cloud. Producer Ben, you went along to meet him. What's he like?
Yes, indeed. I went along on Friday afternoon to Imperial College to see the great man hand in his thesis. And a mighty impressive work it is too. It's got a nice blue hardback cover. There he was with his hair, and it's very easy to have preconceptions about Brian May for that reason, but actually I found him to be an utterly charming and very passionate person about both of his subjects, science and music, and this is what he told me about his research.
In the solar system there are planets and there are asteroids and there are comets and there is also a lot of dust. We call it the zodiacal dust cloud because it mainly lies in the plane of the zodiac, which is the perceived line which the sun travels along as we travel around the sun. So what I did in the 1970s was look at the dust with a spectrometer and look for Doppler shifts in its spectrum. Its spectrum is just reflected sunlight. So if you compare the spectrum of the piece of dust you're looking at with the spectrum of the sun, you ought to be able to see shifts, and that's what we did. So the more the shift, the more the radial velocity, the relative velocity between us and the piece of dust. So the idea was to try and map the motions of this dust.
Now, you mentioned there that you began this back in the 70s, so this really has been a labour of love over 30 years.
Yeah, I had a long gap year. I mean, I was away for quite a while. But yes, it is a labour of love. I really had a strong call to go back to this, having left it almost finished, tantalisingly almost finished in 1974 when we started off going around the world as Queen. It's been a thrill to get back to it. It's also been very tough. There's been moments where I wanted to give up, I have to tell you honestly, because it is tough writing any kind of dissertation, thesis or whatever. You get to points where you think, why did I do this? Why did I commit to this awful bit of work? You know, there are points where you can see no light at the end of the tunnel, and I had a couple of those. But in the end, I'm thrilled that I got there. I had some great help, some great inspiration. I had the head of astrophysics of Imperial College as my personal supervisor, who's been monumentally tough on me, but that was what I needed. I needed it to be gold standard. I needed it to be, I don't want any favours done to me. This is not an honorary thesis, an honorary PhD. This is the real thing.
Would you say that your science and your interest in that has influenced your music in any way? I mean, I would say that Radial Velocities in the Zodiacal Dust Cloud sounds like an absolutely great song title, particularly for a death metal album.
Yeah, it has a certain ring to it, doesn't it? It's a rhythm. Not directly very much is the answer. I don't know if you know, but I did write a song about a song called 39, which chronicles the adventures of an explorer in space, and because of the general relativistic time dilation effect, he returns to Earth a year older, but his family are all gone because it's been 100 years on the Earth. And I was very touched by that sort of scenario and wrote the song about it. That's the closest that I've come, I suppose, to an astronomical theme for a song. Mainly my songs are about feelings and people and relationships. But there is a great relationship, I think, between astronomy and music, which has always been there. A lot of the great astronomers have been musicians and vice versa. I don't know why that should be exactly, but there does seem to be a similar kind of harmony which you seek in both. I don't know if I can put it any more succinctly than that, but astronomy and music definitely go together, just as Patrick Moore's introduction to his Sky at Night always moves you to contemplate the heavens. There is something that inside us gets triggered, I think, by music and astronomy, sort of contemplating the infinite, I suppose.
If you were given the choice of a guitar or your telescope, what would it be?
Oh, a choice of one? That would be very difficult. That would be too hard.
I guess what I'm essentially saying is music or science.
I hope I never have to make the choice again. I think it's, we're sitting, I'm avoiding the question here, you'll notice, but we're sitting in the Imperial College of Science and Technology, which is a huge campus here, and it was all laid out by Prince Albert for arts and sciences. The Royal College of Music sits right in the middle, still, and there's engineering here, there's biology, there's science, and there's music, and originally there was quite a bit of art as well. I think that schools in general tend to make us specialise too much, and I feel like I'm holding a banner for the fact that you can be broad and you can be passionate about more than one part of the pursuit of knowledge or the pursuit of art, however you want to look at it. I like the fact that I perhaps seem to have chosen music over science, but it was never gone from my insides. It was always there. I was always very, very keen. So I'm very lucky that I can do both now.
That was Brian May, and we managed to get through that entire item without a single gag about hair. Almost. Thank you for all your feedback over the past 7 days. By the time you hear this podcast, we will have an almost astounding 400 people on our Facebook network. We're also well on course to getting 2 million downloads of all our shows by the end of the year, but that's probably more interesting for us and the number crunchers than you. Anyway, following last week's show with Ian McEwan, there's been a major literary debate going on the blog, the most concise of which comes from Oasis Boy.
I was just going to attempt a Mancunian accent, but I'm not going to. Great pod as ever, guys. The first episode I downloaded involved a phone call from Mount Everest. I've been hooked ever since. On the topic of science writing, how about a Feynman special? Funny, informative, extremely entertaining, and more than a little endearing. A bit like you lot, actually.
Oh, flattery will...
Feynman special.
Flattery will get you everywhere. But our favourite comment this week comes from Reiko Kawabata in Japan, who responded to our challenge to come up with another word like bookkeeper that has three consecutive double letters.
Three words with three consecutive double letters. I'd suggest sweet tooth, although you could argue it should be hyphenated. I love the show, by the way. I tune in from Tokyo. Keep up the good work.
Nell, you're our official grammarian and Oxbridge English scholar. Sweet tooth, to hyphenate or not, and is bookkeeper the only triple-double?
According to Collins, which is the Guardian dictionary of choice, sweet tooth is indeed hyphenated.
And there we go. We've pronounced on that. Okay, before we go, we've just got a bit more time with Kate Allen, the director of Amnesty International. Bobby, you've got a couple of questions.
Yeah, I was just wondering, we talked a lot about China earlier on, and although, you know, it's a big issue at the moment, there are lots of other countries that are also very repressive on the internet. So I wondered if you could tell us about those.
Yes, now we've seen some recent arrests take place in Malaysia and Egypt of people using the internet in ways, sharing information that governments don't like. But we've also seen in Burma, Tunisia, Iran, Saudi Arabia. I mean, it is actually one of these issues where it's growing. You know, unfortunately, the number of governments who are trying to be repressive about this issue is actually growing. So this is the time for us to make our effort known and to try to change that.
Amnesty has been quite innovative online, isn't it? I believe you're going into Second Life, is that right?
We're doing all sorts of things, but I mean, I think all of this in terms of ways of campaigning is just fabulous. And for an international organisation with a presence in, 70 countries plus around the world, this is the future of campaigning, and we at Amnesty are determined to be at the forefront of that.
Okay, that's it for another week. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed in the show, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or our Facebook wall. My thanks, of course, to everyone in the pod, Bobby Johnson, Ian Sample, Nell Bowes, and our special guest, Kate Allen. We've put up a link to Amnesty's Irrepressible campaign on our site, and we'd encourage you all to get involved. There's also more on the science blog. Remember that our archive is here for you at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.